Okay, so welcome everyone to the June 26, 2019 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes Monthly Call. And glad you're all here. And Craig, you want to start with the roll?
Yeah. All right, so as always, I'll read the names that I have in front of me here. I have Ann Hendricks, Kat McGuire, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Dan Hennen, David Rold, Gerald Pechnuk, James Hufford, John O'Malley, Jonathan Mark, and Carl Golovin, Marty Hopper, Peter Ketchum, and Steve Stadola. So that's who we have so far. I bet you we get some more before we're too far into this. But
okay, so should we go ahead with approving the minutes from the last meeting, and or do you want to
sure.
wait?
Sure. Well, I don't know. It's up to you, Cheryl. I mean, if you think.
Well, we might as well get those out of the way. We have a really packed agenda, so
yeah.
And then
that's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, someone else.
We need to train people to be on time, right? So we need to have all the good stuff at the beginning, so that people won't be late.
Okay. I think Xander just joined us. If I'm.
Correct. Yep. Xander's on the line.
Yeah.
Great.
And Doug West, and, I think, just joined us.
Yep.
Okay. Doug West and Xander Arena. Okay.
Okay, so so let's then look at the minutes from the last meeting, from the May 9/11 and other deep state conference call, other deep state crimes conference call. Any objections to the minutes as they're written? Hearing none, then they're approved. And then we move on to the agenda. Anyone want to make any changes or corrections to the agenda? All right, hearing none, then I guess it's approved as it is. So. Let's begin. All right. So our first speaker tonight is James Hufford, and Sherry Aspen was going to introduce him, but she has to work late, so Ann is going to introduce him for us. Ann?
Yeah, thank you. James, congratulations on your book being published. Excellent.
Thank you.
James Hufford is a Midwestern farm boy, has lived and worked in four U.S. time zones and Rio de Janeiro twice, traveled independently in 20-some countries, including... also in the Arctic and the Amazon area. And he's a graduate of a PhD in geography from the University of Minnesota and was honored as a distinguished alumnus. He taught at universities and colleges for many years. Colonel Crystal's Parallel Universe is his 10th published book to date and 5th published novel. Thank you, James.
Well, thank you.
Before you get rolling, James, Cheryl, do we want to use lecture mode, or what do we normally do?
Yeah, I think maybe we should. Let's see.
Just thinking about, you know, assorted noise in the background of can sometimes be.
Yeah, let me put it into lecture mode here. Okay, here. Okay, and now we have to unmute James, I think, so he can begin. Okay. Okay, James, you're good to go.
Okay, well, I'll try to be in my best lecture mode, I guess. So, whatever. Anyway, I wrote the novel Colonel Crystal's Parallel Universe. I started writing it, I guess, about... I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, actually, and it's taken a lot of revision, a lot of work with editing, with my publisher, which is Trine Day, and we finally got it to the text that we have now. The idea behind it is that. There's two emphases. First of all, I started wondering. I read somewhere on a list. I think it's on our grassroots activist list that one of us, and I won't say who, was an Air Force high-ranking Air Force officer, And I thought, well, that's nice. That's strange that a high-ranking military man would turn into a dissident enough to be want to be listed among 9/11 truthers. But I don't know this individual, and I didn't make any effort to find out more about him. But instead, being a novelist, well, I guess I can call myself a novelist. I've written a few novels. I was naturally wondering what that would be like if a high-ranking military person became the sort of dissident I am. How would that happen, and what would it be like, and what could he do with it? And then the other emphasis is that I've always, one of my worst, or I guess best pet peeves, is that I've always kind of been down on people that wring their hands about some egregious problem and never, ever, ever come up with any solution to it. And such is true with U.S. hypermilitarism that's shown up, well, since World War II and primarily since 9/11, with all of our perpetual wars in the Middle East and such, everybody on our side, all of the dissident community, laments that and cries about it and moans and so on, and nobody ever thinks, I guess, to venture a solution to it. And so I thought, well, here's my character I've chosen. It's a fictional character. It's not really modeled after anybody. It's imaginary. Colonel Crystal, Colonel Alva A. Crystal, was a supposedly top flight commander in Afghanistan and Iraq for several years, and he learns actually through his commanding general, who takes him aside and tells him what's really going on over there, and he becomes he combines that with his own very rough experiences, as you'll find out if you read the book. In the field and in training basically bombers and rough military people. he gets to know some of the and observe a lot of the people who are being bombed and killed in action, and finds that they look a lot, they remind him a lot of people back home where he comes from, and this bothers him a great deal, and so he takes he can't do it anymore, and so he takes early retirement, and he retires to a small town on Florida's Forgotten Coast, which is that stretch of coast around the Big Bend of Florida, halfway between maybe the Panhandle and Tampa, where there's probably mostly swamp along the coast there. There's a little town called Steinhatchee that he settles down in, and it's pretty forgotten corner of the United States, actually, and he starts making a list of all of his grievances against the military and the United States government. Now, these aren't personal grievances, but grievances with the policy and all the myths that are involved in getting Americans and persuading Americans to go along with what's going on in the Middle East. And then he comes up with this concept in concert to begin with this General Montmorency, who is also by that time retired, and they kind of collaborate to begin with. And they come up with this concept of a defense-only military, that you'd have a U.S. military. I mean, we need a military. Every country basically needs a defense organization to protect it from possible invasion by foreign powers. And so we need that, but that's defensive only. That's basically, as I read the Constitution, where the only mention of a military is for the common defense, to provide for the common defense. Well, that doesn't say that the military is to go on adventures and pick fights everywhere overseas and set up 1,000 military bases around forward bases that are armed to the teeth so that they can go on the attack at any given moment. That isn't in the Constitution at all. And in fact, if you know your history, back in the generation or so after the Revolution, people like George Washington were urging that there be no standing army, no standing armies, and certainly no professional navy either. They had this militia idea, and then also to not have a professional navy, to have a merchant marine that would take care of that. Well, that was found to be impractical because there actually were potential enemies that there was some danger of being attacked, and the War of 1812 came along, I think, pretty well dispelled the idea of militias only adequately defending the country. They pretty well got routed by the British and our Canadian friends at that time, and so that wasn't really practical. But still, that didn't say that you go on the rampage like Alexander the Great and every imperial power since then, and pick fights with everybody and try to control them. And so this idea of defense-only military, well, Colonel Crystal had a hard road to get there, actually. He suffered from horrendous PTSD, and he had these horrendous dreams of being back in Iraq, and things that happened or maybe didn't happen that he imagined or heard about, and so it's all really about that. That's basically the book. There are some other themes in the book. My sort of school of writing stories or writing novels says that you definitely need more than one storyline, and you weave them together. Well, I told the whole story of Colonel Crystal and took him from being just a caricature, which he could have been, into being a full-fledged troubled human being who was on a self-appointed mission, and his mission was to sell the world, sell everybody in the United States about this idea of defense-only military. Well, along the way, it occurred to me that basically every other country in the world except the United States already has a defense-only military. To give you an example, our arch rivals and, quote, enemies, China and Russia, each maintain one foreign military base. China just opened their first overseas base about 2 years ago in Djibouti, Africa, And Russia used to have two, but one was in Crimea, which they annexed, so they've only got one now. The United States has pretty close to 1,000 known military bases in the world, and so it doesn't even compare. The mission of every other country's military is to defend that country, and ours is to conquer the world, I guess, but it isn't working out anyway. And besides that, another real selling point for defense-only military is the fact that we're paying for it. So there's only maybe as small as 1% of the population that strongly push for the kind of imperial military that we have now, which is enormously expensive, and especially for a country that's economy is built on the fumes of $25 trillion debt, and from one source the real debt is $75 trillion. We can't afford what it would take to conquer the world, and that's part of the reason why we're failing at it. But that doesn't leave the taxpayer off the hook. And I figure, you know, it's always stated that a certain fraction of your income, I think maybe, just a rough estimate, maybe somebody knows the figures a lot better than I do, but maybe as much as a fifth of our economic output goes to maintain these wars and bases, and basically I call it all blood money. And just think, if our economy was, let's say, for lack of a better number, one-fifth larger, your financial problems would probably not be nearly as big, and the country's financial problem. Maybe we could fix our infrastructure. Maybe we could have a better education system. All sorts of benefits could accrue from not having to spend all of that money in killing people and forcing people to do what we want to do and taking away their freedom to do what they want to do. And so that's the other, I guess, branch of the argument. One is the old humanitarian branch that probably, you take, for instance, in Iraq or Syria, most of the people we were fighting against were probably not very political. They were either saving their country, or they were potential collateral damage to civilians in their homes that we bombed or broke in and shot everybody and things like that. Imagine if that was your neighborhood. So there's certainly still, I think, some traction to be gained from the humanitarian argument. But also you have this economic argument where we'd all be a lot better off financially if we didn't have that burden. And at the same time, I don't really think that our military is doing that great a job of defending us when we have this huge invasion at our southern border. If the military was defense only, the military would maybe put up a wall down there of people that just bounce people, illegals, out, you know, and you wouldn't have. Pretty soon they'd get the hint, and they wouldn't keep coming back, and that problem would be solved too. So I don't think that the military is concentrating on what its mission should be, but on this starry-eyed Alexander the Great conquer the world mission that is. is not only brutal and keeps the world on edge, but brutalizes our culture. And I can't think of anything good to say about it, and I'm anxious in the question period to see if you can, if you give me any pushback on this, because I'm sure there must be some valid arguments against converting to a defense-only military, but I don't know what they are. And I think that Americans deserve a choice between the kind of military we have and a defense-only military. And I would like to do everything I can to promote this idea. I don't know exactly how to go about it. I'm going to write an article and try to submit it to as many newspapers around the country as I can. Maybe if some money, of which I have absolutely none, came into play, maybe some try to get some TV ads up or something. Because all we'd have to do is get people aware of it and get people demanding a defense-only military. Now, that's a pretty good catchphrase, don't you think? I don't think anti-war has had a catchphrase like that before that makes any sense. I mean, we don't want to do away with the military entirely. We just want to state rules for it and enforce those rules on it. And I think a lot of our problems as a country would be solved in that way. What do you think?
Okay, let me just put everybody into... Okay, so if you'd like to ask a question of James, it's *6 to get in the queue. And while we're waiting for people to do that, James, I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, our government does call our military like the Defense Department, you know, so they're kind of making it seem like that's what it is. And also, I think that if you try to do that, or if that ever tries to be done, we'd have to define what defense is, because, like, you know, right now they're saying that Iran is, you know, a danger to us, and we'd have to defend ourselves from them. So I think it would have to be really clearly defined on that. Okay, now James is muted. James, sorry, you were muted.
On a debate about it, and we could hone it down. We could define what we're talking about. And my definition is that if we're not attacked militarily by another country, but we attack them without military provocation, then it's not defense. It's offensive. In other words, going on the offense and not the defense. And I think an awful lot of our wars have been that way. Incidentally, over a credibly estimated 60 million people have lost their lives due to U.S. Started wars since the end of World War II, and that's far more than U.S. forces or allied forces. If you take Russia out of that equation with their Eastern Front, killed in World War II itself. So we've never stopped really being at war.
Yeah. Well, I really want to thank you for writing the book. I'm halfway through it now, so when I'm done with it, I may have a conversation with you.
Okay.
And I just wanted to say Tulsi Gabbard is kind of talking like you're talking. She's not saying a defense only.
I contacted Tulsi Gabbard, and I tried to. I wrote to, about a year and a half ago. I wrote repeatedly to her or emailed her office in Washington, and I was trying to get her to read my manuscript and see if I could get her to write a foreword to it. I never got an answer. I did get on her mailing list, though.
All right. So we have a couple people in the queue. Jonathan, you're up first. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. James, this is interesting. You know that President Kennedy proposed the same idea of a defensive mechanism. Based on his concern from the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was talking to Khrushchev as a, with the idea of abolishing all the weapons of mass destruction and forming a through the UN forming a force that would enforce it, and it would work the same way, where there'd be a united group of nations making weapons and technologies capable of the mass destruction illegal, and just each country keeping just their own forces for their own defense and internal conflict, and certainly that's his direction. And when he was murdered, they started giving Israel the nukes and started this foreign policy. So this is a coup d'etat of his assassination, as he was planning to, end the military-industrial complex, as was warned to him by Eisenhower.
Right. Well, he's one of my heroes.
Okay. And then, Sherry Jacobs, you're next.
I just wanted to say thank you. This is Sherry in San Diego. I was going to introduce you. I'm sorry, I just couldn't quite make it home from work. But thank you for your book, and I'm going to get it and read it. Thank you. I just don't think that our troops, though, what you said something about that our troops would be down at the border because of, I don't think that what's going on at the border has anything to do with defense. So I just kind of wanted to make that comment. So
well,
thank you. I'll
No, I understand. Maybe it doesn't.
Okay, so anyone else have a question for Jane?
Oh. Yeah, Cheryl, Craig, could I ask one?
Yep, go ahead.
I have a quick comment and then a question that's sort of a little bit off the topic of the content of the book, but more sort of, well, I'll get to that in a second, but I just wanted to mention in terms of the defense-only thing that this was very much part of the platform of Ron Paul when he was running for president.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah, he used to talk about the fact that we have no, we, I mean, I'm not an American, but the U.S. has no business having bases all over the world, and that it should only have bases on U.S. soil. So, and he obviously ran into a lot of resistance in the media, but at least it got into a major presidential campaign, at least.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very good.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to throw another a question. I'm kind of curious about the challenges. What are the challenges involved in actually getting a book published on any subject that might sort of be peripherally related to, any kind of dissenting kind of position like the ones you sort of include in your book. Just in terms of getting published and getting a publisher and selling the book, what are some of the challenges that are involved in that?
Well, the biggest challenge is selling the book. I haven't had tremendous problems in finding publishers. What you do is you take books that you look at your own library and you see what books you have that are in some way in subject or maybe just in tone similar to what your project is, and you start looking them up online to see if they'll accept unagented, unless you can get an agent, that's harder than finding a publisher. But you just submit to them and correspond with them, and if they're interested, they'll let you know, and you go on. They'll offer you a contract, and you go on from there. Every book I've written is totally different from every other book I've written, so I find myself having to find new publisher almost every time. I'm in kind of a streak of about four books so far that all are on major, what I perceive as huge problems or something that isn't publicized enough or that I want to make arguments on now. And so I'm going to go back to Trine Day and try those, but they're all on different subjects. So I guess I've become kind of an old hand at finding this level of publisher. Trine Day is the closest I've found to a major publisher. I don't know if you'd call them a major publisher, but they will look at anything. Basically, what you have to have is a subject that's controversial, and that's what they're interested in. That's their specialty. So I'd try there, but look at your book collection and find books that are in some way or fashion like what you want to submit and contact them. And that's what.
Great, thanks.
And then again, there's some subjects that probably you're not going to find a publisher, and I've self-published about three or four books before, and you can do that. That's pretty easy. That's very easy to do. You can't really be turned down on that.
Mm-hmm.
Although the marketing is all up to you then.
Right.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, James.
Sure.
Okay, James, I think that's it for our questions. So I want to thank you so much for presenting and for writing the book and all the other books you've written.
Well, you're certainly welcome. And anybody else who is going to read the book, I would very much appreciate your feedback after you've read it.
Okay.
So keep that in mind, please.
All right, James. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay.
Great.
So now we're going to go on to the next speaker, which will be Jonathan Mark, speaking about the moon landing. And I'm just going to put us back in. And Jonathan, I'm going to unmute you. There you go.
Okay. I think I'm open here.
Okay, yeah. And Craig is going to introduce you.
Yeah. Great. So Jonathan Mark, through his website Flyby News, has been active in opposing the spread of military weaponry into space, which was accelerated after 9/11 when George W. Bush terminated the IBM treaty. After the 10th anniversary of 9/11, he produced a video compilation called Dark Legacy, JFK and 9/11. This covered four key conspiracies and how truth could turn a failed republic back into a democracy. July 20th of this year marks the 50-year anniversary of the Giant Leap for Mankind claim by NASA. And Jonathan's going to talk to us tonight about some of the evidence that points to the Apollo missions being staged. In fact, he says that we do not even have the capability of launching such missions today, never mind with 1960s technology. So I'll just pass it over to Jonathan now.
Thanks, Craig. And thanks, everyone that's interested in this topic. A 50th anniversary only comes once in a lifetime, so that's why Flyby News, in dealing with this issue for many years, decided to give it a real strong effort because of the science proving and even admissions by NASA that they first have to learn how to protect the astronauts through the radiation fields before they could send any astronaut beyond low Earth orbit. And the main thing that affects people into believing the moon landing is the idea of a big lie. It was coined by Hitler, but it's certainly been used by this government. And they figure after they could pull off a Kennedy assassination and coup d'etat and having a shadow government and enforcing a foreign policy for this military-industrial complex, it goes back, you know, since Operation Paperclip and World War II and even before then. So there's a plan that World War II really never ended, and the infiltration of the U.S. government happened through Operation Paperclip, and the CIA was born in 1947 because of the atomic bomb. And it scared people so much that they gave this intelligence group the right to go against the Constitution and have no oversight if they saw it as national security interests. And, you know, and Truman made a big mistake, and they came off, and we've been dealing with this type of shadow government ever since. So so no wonder that the William Colby, who is a former director of the CIA, said that we own every one of major significance of the mainstream media. And without this history of JFK and these regime changes and the development of the media element, 9/11 could never have happened. But, you know, people don't want to go there in, you know, deciding that the government actually did this, because they're scared, and so there's a fear element. And after 10 years of utilizing 9/11 to, you know, say that this is so damn obvious, you know, it's, people just don't want to go there. So I looked to something into the future, which was really the exploration of outer space, and they're going to have to either keep lying about what they claim to have done in 1960s technologies and keep suppressing the truth, or they'll have to own up to it. And if they own up to it, this could redirect the country because of the popular uprising of all these people realizing they've been under cognitive dissonance most of their lives, that they're going to demand change. And we set up a plan in an article called Litmus Test for Truth and Transformation that offers truth and reconciliation for whistleblowers throughout the world for any criminal to get amnesty for telling the truth, and to be a whole international element of a new beginning, which could engage a new platform for the economy to work towards sustainable directions rather than exploitation directions, and then those ideas of a military policy. But without the atomic bombs being subsided and abolished, that's going to be very difficult. So Flyby News' first campaign was to stop weapons from entering space, because we figured if we stopped the expansion of the arms race, it could implode or, you know, just stop. But we weren't successful. It was the anti-ballistic missile treaty that was terminated by Bush Jr., after 9/11, and then weapons have gone into space, and we continue on this foreign policy direction with the shadow government controlling every president around. So you have someone like George Bush Jr. that stole the presidency in 2000 and Al Gore backing down, and then you have 9/11 happening, and then you have Obama coming in to give cover to George Bush, and then you have, you know, a reaction to a Trump that, you know, it's like the elements are pulling people one way and the other way. But meanwhile, this military-industrial complex, the military always gets funded based on where it's going. What's going to happen in 2020 is going to be very significant if we can have a real peace candidate that there's about four or five of them that would like to utilize the extraordinary funding of the Pentagon for social issues and care for our planet. So there's still hope, but I think 2019 being this 50th anniversary, I just want to encourage people to get into it a little bit. I know people will be condescending and they're so convinced, and it's like the debunkers with 9/11, because you just ask them, well, how long will it take for you to be skeptical of these claims while they're stay in low Earth orbit? And so you just turn the issue around, and then you confront them with that question, and it's very hard for them to give an answer to it, because they don't want to say for my whole life or another 10 or 20 years, but that's what's going to happen. So it could take another 10 years, could take 20 years. Sooner or later, truth is going to prevail, because I don't think we're going to be capable of that sort of technology for protection of astronauts and to land and launch off and dock in another area for the rest of this century. And sooner or later, people are going to wake up. I welcome questions, and thank you so much for listening.
I think.
And now my mind is blank.
Cheryl, you were actually muted there, so if you've been talking, we didn't hear you.
Oh, okay, great. So I said I was going to ask Jonathan a question while we were waiting for people to get in the queue, but I forgot my question, so I'll
and
ask
then, and then people got in the queue, yeah.
I mention, I just did another video for Flyby News. We do work out of the Greenfield Community Television Station, and so we produce a 28-minute program, Has Man Been to the Moon 50 Years Ago?, with the best information that I could find that uses some of the films of Massimo Mizuko, the Vedic Observer, that did a great video on YouTube that I couldn't do any better, so I used his stuff, and also Bart Sibrel. And he was also on Veritas Radio. And Sibrel, in Sibrel's film, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, we're going to show on the July 20th at the library, because that was the film that kind of woke me up to the issue. But it also has out footage from NASA that shows the three astronauts in Apollo 11 faking being halfway to the moon while they were in low Earth orbit. And Sibrel on this recent radio show is asking for any supporters to help launch a lawsuit that would bring this to court to with witnesses to, you know, show this fraudulent behavior that they have evidence for.
Okay, so we have a lineup here of questions. Ian, you're first. Go ahead.
Hi. I guess that's me.
Yes.
This is Ann. Thank you, Jonathan, for your presentation. Oh, very interesting.
Thank you.
My interest is in the nature of the moon. There are a lot of arguments about the moon landings and the hoax and look at the shadows and various things. But it seems to me like the most obvious issue is that when you look at the ground from any of the NASA photos or the other space agencies that claim to are going there or close to it, the ground is not reflective. So on that point only, people should wake up and say, those are just fake pictures. Because if we were taught, and we were taught for hundreds of years, that the moon is reflecting the sunlight. So if you just look at the ground that the astronauts are on, or the lander, it is not reflective. Why does no one even mention that in their arguments? The nature of the moon is different than NASA presented to us, because we see the moonshine with our own eyes. We can see that with our own eyes. So if we look at any of the space photos or the space agency photos, we can see, well, obviously there's no reflective material. They landed in daylight, they walked around in daylight, and it is not reflecting. That's the first most critical point. The second one is the distance that we are told, 239,000 miles, and that's supposed to that is supposed to have like an effect on the tides. The moon could not be that far from us if it has an effect on the tides. But I think the first issue is the most important thing, and it is important because it goes to the magnitude of the deception that astronomy has, the astronomy that has been presented to us, that we've been taught for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I'd like to add, too, that not only were they standing on the moon and not knowing there was any water to the moon, and it took them many years later with robotic missions to explode into the dust and follow up with a sensor to say, hey, there's water on the moon. So here, you know, besides the reflectivity, they're not even noticing, you know, what they're standing on. They couldn't tell that there was any moisture. But you're right, moon is a big mystery, the way it works with us, and there's a lot more that we don't know about than we do. But the element of the filmmakers, like the architects with 9/11, the filmmakers have their expertise that could see staging in every frame of them being on the moon. With background, foreground, with a line, and that's what Massimo's film does extraordinarily well, besides the Orion mission where the engineers claiming they, you know, they can't get beyond low Earth orbit because of the intensity. So space is much more volatile than we learned from Star Trek and everything. And there's, you know, micrometeorites and other elements. But we're so protected by our radiation field that it's important to note, too, that the military, in their frustration of wanting to get through, exploded a nuclear bomb about 400 miles from the Earth. And that was publicized in the UPI. And they also used a hydrogen bomb to test in the upper atmosphere. So this is the mentality of these people that, you know, don't know what they're doing, really, and they made things worse with getting through that field.
Okay. Great. Kat, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Kat. And my question has to do with the recent bombshell document that Richard Dolan called the leak of the century. The UFO sites are really just aflame with this. And I was wondering, Jonathan, are you familiar with the USAPs that are talking about this? It has to do with the Admiral Wilson, who was denied classified USO programs, UFO programs. And this document was just recently released maybe a month ago or something. And I was wondering what your take is on it. And if you need more information, I can talk about that. But I thought
I could need more information. What does USO stand for?
UFO.
Yeah, what does that stand for?
Unidentified flying objects.
Oh, UFO, yeah.
UFO, yeah.
Okay,
but what,
yeah.
What happened was these USAPs, do you know what USAP is?
No.
Oh, well, SAPs are special access projects that the military has that of and by themselves are like dark holes. But
right.
Then what was finally, many people have known about this for a long time, but what was finally revealed is that there are unacknowledged special access projects, which are called USAPs, and these USAPs are all manner of really out there stuff. They're the ones that have gotten the spaceships from Roswell and the alien from Roswell. All of that is in a released document that everybody, many people have known, but now it's in writing. And that was Admiral Wilson, who was denied access to these unacknowledged SAPs. So,
yeah,
I guess
am basically really skeptical that, you know, the UFOs are working with us, or that we have this secret space force that has bases already on the moon, just be based on the technology that we haven't been able to develop far enough to really get through there. But and I don't believe we do have anti-gravity. And if we did, we would, you know, see. But I follow the idea of, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary hard evidence. And there's so much disinformation and purposeful disinformation just to confuse people. So, you know, we end up, you know, debating theories rather than, you know, finding what are the facts that prove this or prove that. And we have to be careful of the disinformation. It's really hard to tell sometimes.
I agree with you, Jonathan, and up to 2 months ago, I would have said exactly what you're saying, but with this release of this bombshell document that most people don't know about because it's not in the mainstream media, of course they don't want it there, but it is pretty much, by experts who know about these things, says it's pretty unassailable, and that there's all kinds of information about the free direct energy that's been learned. It's a 15-page document. It's pretty extraordinary. People might want to look into it.
Yeah, it's on the telecon listserv. That'd be great to see.
Okay. Will do. Well, actually, part of the reason this is being pushed out there is Netflix has the documentary with Dr. Stephen Greer called Unacknowledged, and millions of people have seen it now, and that has, he believes, that's what has pushed this extraordinary release out by a military leaker. But I'll put that out there.
Yeah, the best military evidence that I found regarding UFOs is the hearings that were in Washington, D.C. at the press conference. It was in 2001, but it was also in 2010 without any monetary interest. I know Steve Greer was involved with it early on, but now these military people went together on themselves talked about what they witnessed while in the military in the bunkers with UFOs hovering outside and being able to shut down their nuclear weapons. And the Rendlesham Forest incident is the most documented military case as well, and I think that's the extent of the UFOs, I think, that, you know, the military is freaked out about them because they can shut off their nukes. And so, but meanwhile, these soldiers that have come forth felt like it was a good lesson and we need to listen to them. They're coming with a message rather than a demand or a threat.
Right. I watched both of those. I saw the Citizen one, and I saw the one in 2001 that Dr. Greer did, both of them for disclosure. And Dr. Stephen Greer is at the center of this new bombshell document that was released.
Yeah, I've lost some trust in him, but that's maybe me. But
I've been used to either, but now people who I do trust, Richard Dolan, and he said Stephen Greer on this one is 100% there. So that, for me, is the stamp of truth.
Okay, I'm open. We'll see. Bart Jordan has some really interesting information about the ancient language of the Hellenic Greek and other pre-Ice Age civilizations that passed down information of this pre-Ice Age civilization that was placed the two moons into orbit around Mars and set up this Cydonia region where its monuments, basically warning us about nukes and saying that this is the breaking the covenant, is exploding these nuclear weapons that's abusing the light, and that if you don't put them away, you go extinct, and if you can put them away, you could sustain yourselves. And that's the message that I hope we go back to with the 1976 Mars Viking mission. But ever since then, they've been covering that up and just covering a lot of stuff up. But it's been an interesting lifetime.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kat, for the question. Dan Hennen, you're next.
Hi, this is Dan. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi.
I have a question regarding Buzz Aldrin. I know he's kind of the weak link here with perpetuating this lie. And since his medical evacuation from Antarctica a couple of years ago, I've been kind of wondering what's been going on with him and getting up there in age. And it was very interesting to me to watch the State of the Union address with Donald Trump pointing straight at him, looking him in the face on the spot, asking about these ridiculous Mars and ridiculous going back to the moon things. And Mr. Buzz Aldrin looked like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs when he gave that statement. Is he getting closer to breaking this full-fledged lie all these years? I think Trump kind of put him on the spot.
Yeah, if he's drunk enough, it seems like he might, but it wouldn't matter whatever he says, because then he'll go back against it because of the threats are so severe that it's not just to him, it's to his family or to others. So, you know, he'll maintain the status quo. Like Neil Armstrong, I thought he got worse and worse as he got older, and you would want him to have come forth in a true way, but he hadn't, and so I don't expect much from any of the astronauts. And Bart Jordan met with one of the astronauts, Alan Shepard, from Derry, New Hampshire. They lived near each other, and Bart Jordan confronted him about going along with the spectacle of the moon landing. He says, "Well, I'm in uniform. You know, you do something about it. You know, these people are under threat." And what happened with Gus Grissom and the other two astronauts in Apollo 1, well, it was a clear message. That's the shadow government. They use these type of hitmen that make people make their cover-ups more effective than if they weren't around. So they can bend a lot of different individuals. And that's why truth is so necessary to free ourselves.
Yep. And I was kind of more going toward the angle that I think Trump knows this and is trying to expose these guys, and did it in a very cunning way at that State of the Union, because I think he knows full well and is.
Well, he plays
hopefully
the game. He's not really trying to expose them. Otherwise, he would have released the Kennedy assassination report if he was going to confront them released that whole report.
Well, the Kennedy assassination, that was the CIA held that up. Trump wasn't able to get that.
He asked the CIA if they had any problems with releasing it. When you ask the CIA that, what do you expect? You know,
he's not going to do anything
because he has so many flaws and they have so much over him that he's in it for himself and his ego and his ideas, but.
I still hold hope that he's trying to expose it. I would follow more of the Q anon if you get a chance, because it's going to be a very interesting next couple of weeks, I think, here with this administration. We're living
That'd
in historic
nice.
Times. Very good. Thank
nice
you.
Nice if he stays away from the Iranian situation. There should never have been the weapons right next door that, you know, is waiting for a false flag to engage everything. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, another false flag is all that is. Thank you.
Okay, great. Next is Peter Ketchum. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when I first started investigating the moon landing, which was probably maybe about a year ago, and this is maybe just a comment, but I found that I had the same reaction as I did when I started investigating the World Trade Center collapses, that there was this mounting pile of evidence. And, you know, each piece of evidence by itself in isolation may not have been all that compelling, but added all together, it was sort of overwhelming. The thing that I'm kind of most fascinated by is these Van Allen radiation belts that you mentioned. And there is this video produced by NASA. It's a young NASA engineer, and he's talking about the Orion spacecraft and how much difficulty they're going to have getting through these radiation belts.
Right.
And when I looked it up about, I said, well, what does Wikipedia have to say about the Apollo missions? And they more or less say, well, the Apollo spacecraft just went through the Van Allen belt so fast that it didn't really matter.
Yeah,
which of course begs the question.
And the building's falling down.
right. And of course that begs the question, well, if they could just go through it fast back in 1969, why can't we just go through it fast again? So they also
classified the evidence that they measured at the Orion mission, that the military called it national security interest and won't let you know what they measured.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Because that would... I guess my question is, I find this piece the most frustrating to deal with because I don't understand enough about the Van Allen radiation belts or how much shielding you would have to have. So I get frustrated when I read an explanation like in Wikipedia that just sort of blithely says, well, they just flew through it fast.
Yeah, Art DeBrow has some really good common sense ways of looking at it. He said that there's never been an aeronautical achievement successful on its first try from Kitty Hawk to Lindbergh, and once they did accomplish it, it would be followed up right away.
Right.
And so with all the incentives of you know, that type of ability, so that makes it obvious alone as well. And it's a great lesson for cognitive dissonance because it's going to make everyone aware of it. Where right now people are so in denial that they don't want to know about it, and the same thing we dealt with 9/11 deniers, we're dealing with the moon landing. But now that's the 50th anniversary. I'm doing a public showing at my library of the a funny thing happened on the way to the moon and another, and have discussion. But I think it's a good time to, because more people are going to question it because things are so weird anyway. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe a few years ago, it would be harder, you know. But most people know about 9/11 now, but they only still don't want to talk about it. But they know about it, but they'll have to talk about this moon thing because they're going to be pushing the propaganda.
Yeah, I'm hoping so too. That all the celebratory 50th anniversary will also have the effect of making people say, wait a second, it's been 50 years and we still haven't gone back?
Yeah. And Massimo's film is now online, so on Vimeo On Demand. It's funny.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You can buy it for $8 to own or $4 to rent.
Very good, because I've been wanting to watch it.
Yeah, 3.5 hours. It's a stellar job, and he has a good sense of humor during it, so he helps you get through it because he's such a professional as a filmmaker. Now and then it makes it all the sense in the world when he shows you. And he goes to all these other filmmakers, and they're all telling you what they see in these pictures and videos.
Sure. Okay, well, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Next, Xander, you're next. Go ahead.
Okay, hey there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, great. So just a few comments. I'm kind of late to the party on this thing, but I've watched American Moon. Very compelling, very impressive. A couple pieces of really damning footage in there. I watched A Funny Thing That Happened on the Way to the Moon. Equally impressive. I noticed while searching for that particular video on YouTube recently to show a physician friend of mine, there's a lot of other material with the exact same name that is not the Sobrel work. And so I don't know if that's an attempt to kind of muddy the content out there or what, but definitely provide direct links to people, not just the name of that. I agreed with the previous commenter about the State of the Union. I think that the exchange between Trump and Aldrin was unique and worth paying attention to. I don't know what it means necessarily, but I think that it was revealing that Trump knows. And for better or worse or whatever it means. The main question I have is, have you and Massimo gotten together, worked together on any projects? That's one question. And the other thing, you mentioned that the one bit of radiation data is being withheld. Do we have any radiation information from the early surveyor probes, the robotic craft that went there? Is any of that available? I'm interested because of my background in radiation science and radiation physics.
Well, you know about the Van Allen test, and when he sent the Geiger counter up, it kind of stopped totally in recording it because it was too high. And then
it's called dead time,
down,
yeah. It overwhelms the detector.
But yeah. They've been keeping that a secret, and they claim there's, but it's all, you know, taken over by military, so there's very little information that you really get from NASA. That's what the Cassini was about, was a takeover where NASA was going to do their bidding, and they were using these radioisotope thermal generators decaying plutonium to develop their systems and have to worry about the high, the big solar arrays, you know, and they have a lot of plans. And I think where Massimo and I connected, we you know, he lives in Italy, and I don't see him too often, but we're aware of the same thing, the Project for a New American Century, and they're publishing their plans for Vision 2020 in around 1999, 98, and saying that they needed something like a new Pearl Harbor. And so he's done all this, you know, touching these different issues. But as a filmmaker, you know, the moon thing was a big thing. And so I'm glad you've seen it. I think people should, you know, really help him get out there even more so, because he's one of a kind investigative reporter and filmmaker. But the filmmakers have done good. Also, James Percy and What Happened on the Moon. I like that Vedic guy. He did the 8-minute program that's in my latest film. NASA admits, you know, not going, and he just spelled out the whole issue of the atmosphere and the temperatures and the some of the impact and why there hasn't been, you know, no one trying to get through there. And when they tried to go in 98, they only got to around 350 miles, and the radiation was too intense, and CNN called it killer electrons. So that's as far as they got with the shuttles, and they always will have an explanation of how they got through back then, but they won't demonstrate it. And they'll claim they're going to do it in 2024, and then it's going to become 2030, and it's going to just keep being pushed back. And sooner or later, the people are going to have to know what's true. But I think sooner the better, because of the connection with the Kennedy assassination. I think how Kennedy was used for that issue, I think it would reengage his direction for a foreign policy and a republic, which was... you know, killed with him in 1963. And that's why they can do all these crazy things they've been doing.
Okay.
I'm sure there's a lot of people in government that, you know, want to fight this, and they just don't know how, because you know these guys are you know, they have the ability
I want to jump in real fast. This, like 9/11, there's a lot of evidence that we can use on this one that's in the public domain. So I'm about ready to come out of the closet on this particular issue that we did not send men in the Apollo missions to the lunar surface. So, yeah,
well,
that's where I'm at. All right, hey, thanks.
Wrong person, because you got condescended upon, so be ready for the response. But
I don't care. The evidence is there, yeah. Yeah.
That's what I had to convince myself what is rather than what I wanted it to be. And then when you look at what is, you know, truth is too special to deny. Thank you so much for that.
Okay, great. Sherry Jacobs is next. Go ahead, Sherry.
Hi, this is Sherry in San Diego. You are the gentleman that authored Dark Legacy that brought us from the JFK assassination all the way up and connected all the dots to 9/11, is that correct?
Yeah, I used part one of the film by John Hankey, Dark Legacy, George Bush and the Murder of John F. Kennedy, which kind of spells out the whole film, but his other parts go into it deeper. But then I used all these other excerpts that I found on YouTube at the time to deal with my frustrations of dealing with this issue for 10 years.
Oh, so it's George Hankey that did that original Dark Legacy then?
Yeah, on Kennedy's assassination.
Oh.
He also did a documentary on Trump called Is Trump for Real? And he's showing some fascist ties regarding Bannon and how they got Trump to, you know, be a populist to, you know, raise the race issues and you know, manipulate things.
Right. Well, Adam Green is pretty, I think he's the best news going right now, is Adam Green, as far as triangulating information about the Trump administration and Israel. I think Adam Green pretty good. But anyway, I wanted to thank the person who did that Dark Legacy, because that's what first woke me up to what was going on in our country. I got hit by a car, and I was stuck on the couch watching with YouTube. I discovered that, and that woke me up. So I wanted to thank him.
Yeah, he has a website at thedarklegacy.com, and John Hankey, and I have his email address. He's on this list, I think, of recipients of this teleconference, but he's a dear one.
That was amazing work. Anyway, so I have never really dived into the moon thing, because I'm so overwhelmed with 9/11,
Part one is on 9/11, and part two is on these other issues, but it's a 2-hour and 24-minute film, but I have a 58-minute condensed version that's been watched on YouTube about 28,000 times, and you'll see it from flybynews.com under Dark Legacy on the YouTube and on the condensed version.
Okay, I'll definitely tune in. And is it true about when you... those fake shows, pictures of the moon, if we were really on the moon, would we see stars?
Yeah, they just have to, identify with the aperture of the telescope or the camera to focus on the stars. They just didn't want to focus on them because they can get caught, you know, by taking pictures with that angle, and, you know, other astronomers would be able to expose it. But so they claimed it was reflection.
If you really, truly had taken that picture on the moon with that aperture, the way they did it, of that guy standing there with the flag, would we have seen stars?
No, it would just be too bright to cross out the stars. If it was done on the speed shutter, and the they'd have to focus in on it and slow down the speed of the camera taking the shots to absorb the light.
And is it true that we see the flag waving on one of those videos that we grew up with?
Yeah.
Is it true that the flag could not ever have waved on the moon because there's no breeze?
Well, you'll have the debunkers giving you some reasons that it was unfolded and it was a springy thing, but then you see it standing by itself and being moved without anything touching it. So I think you'll hear the debunkers, but, yeah, there's no atmosphere on. And then there's no sound.
Okay.
They have times when you hear sound on there, and the guy banging something, and it's all ridiculous. I think there's a lot of whistleblowers trying to get the truth out. They even had a letter C on one of the rocks that they ended up airbrushing out after a while, after a few images. But
did President Kennedy know about this scam?
He knew that it was going to be too hard to go to the moon, and he was starting to question it and said, you know, we can do a lot more with the money. And then he, 63, before he was killed, he went to Russia, and he wanted to go with them to the moon. He said, let's do this together, and, you know, you guys are so far ahead of us. And they said, no, we couldn't do it, you know, safely. You just do it. And that's what Russia said, and they still never have gone beyond low Earth orbit. So, you know, for some reason, you know, they kept quiet about it, but, you know, they probably got something for it, and they have a time when they'll release it.
Huh. And
I'm sorry,
CNN right now is airing a whole big thing on the moon landing, so they must be getting a little shaky of the truth, because now they're reaffirming the lie right now.
Yeah, you're creating it more and more. And there's another Science Channel show that was about the moon landing that did bring up some really good points that I didn't even know about this, like, whistleblower that testified for Congress before the moon landing took off, and he had a 500-page report on it, and that his family and him were killed by a train, and they claim it was suicide or an accident, and the report's missing, you know, and it was very highly critical of Apollo with the moon landing direction. So.
Well, please, thank you very much for all your work and dedication, and please be careful.
Yeah, and check out my extensive resources on this issue. It feels good to have it used. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Marty Hopper is the last one with a question for you, Jonathan.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Marty.
Okay, hi, Jonathan. This is Marty. Calling from Boulder, Colorado, and I just had two quick points, and one was that on the conference call with Mazuko, someone at the end, I can't remember who, made a recommendation to listen to a podcast called Wagging the Moon Doggy.
Yes.
And I did that. It's a multi-part podcast, and I thought it was excellent, and deals with all these issues that people are asking about, you know, and I thought that was very, very well done. Someone has read the writing of another individual. It's called the Center for an Informed America.
Yeah, that's a great group.
Yeah, Wagging the
David McGowan, he died, but his daughter is taking over that website and supporting all his work. That he's covered a lot of issues.
Yeah, that was it. So someone read McGowan's writing on this because they thought, we've got to get this out there. So that was just the one point. And my second point was to Peter's question about the Van Allen radiation belts, because that's also just like, I can't get past that. Like, really? How did we do that? And recently, my husband Bob and I were at the, we live in Boulder, and the University of Colorado is here in Fisk. This is like Science Central in this town, and astronomy, and we went to hear a presentation by Jack Burns, who's a professor of astrophysics and a bigwig at NASA and exploring the moon and all this. And so I asked him, how did the astronauts get through the Van Allen radiation belts? And he said the exact thing that Peter got that same answer, which is, oh, they just went through so quickly. And then he just missed it and turned around and walked, you know, off to hear the other question. It's like, what, if you get a really quick X-ray or something, you don't get any radiation, or a quick, atomic bomb. You don't. It's very frustrating. But those were just my two points. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty. I learned about cognitive dissonance from 9/11 and you guys out there in Colorado.
Yeah. Thanks.
And Jonathan, I just have a question. This is Cheryl. I just have one question. Why would they want to fake this? I mean, I agree with you on everything you've said, but I'm just wondering why. What was the point in that?
Well, it was like a military psychological operation that was involved with the Cold War, but I think they just, a little bit crazy people. I mean, they're a lot of hubris and felt like they could do it, and they promised the people that it was going to happen for the hype did so long, and when they found like there was this obstacle, they decided to, you know, they didn't want to risk the life of an astronaut and get caught with them
being killed, so they just use the movie direction. But I think that's why where they want to go. They want to be able to do things that people won't question. So 9/11, the moon landing, JFK, all those are all related.
Okay. All right, thank you. So thank you very much for that presentation, Jonathan, and maybe you'll come on and talk to us again more about that. Seems like
yeah,
a pretty interesting
thank
topic.
You.
Okay, great. So now we're going to put everybody back go ahead.
Can we check, once you undo the Q&A thing, there's some...
Sorry, Craig?
There's somebody that joined the call about 45 minutes ago with a 917 phone number, starts with 917. Now they're muted, so they can't speak, but it would be nice to get them on the roll.
Let me unmute them.
Nita Renfrew.
Oh, Nita.
Oh, Nita Renfrew.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm on my cell phone because my landline hasn't worked for 6 weeks.
Okay.
The system is crumbling.
Well, thanks for joining us, Nita. Okay, so now we are going to go to our third speaker on the list, which is Gerald Pechenuk. Did I say that right? And he's going to be introduced by Ian. So let me unmute everybody here. Okay, Ian. Okay, Ian and Gerald. Okay, so you're both unmuted. Ian, you can take it away with the introduction.
Okay. Gerald Pechenuk is a longtime political activist and writer with the LaRouche PAC and the Executive Intelligence Review, and a campaign manager for hundreds of citizens' candidates' campaigns for elective office. Pechenuk, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, is best known for the mid-1980s victories of the LaRouche PAC candidates in Illinois and other Midwest states, and is presently residing in the Bay Area of California. Thank you for joining us tonight with your presentation.
Okay, thank you. So I'll be brief and to the point. The presentation has to do with what I mentioned to Cheryl and so forth, is ending perpetual war and surveillance nightmare of the post-9/11 era. And I met a gentleman who I think is known to most of you, named William Binney, former technical director of the National Security Agency, a man who had a gun put to his head by Mueller in 2007, and was guilty of the crime of saying 9/11 was allowed to happen, never should have happened, and could have been stopped, would have been stopped. And so we're still living today, as all of you know, with the lies, with living with the lies. And it's kind of like we're chipping around the edges of getting people to see this or that aspect of it. And when I met Bill Binney February, President's Day weekend in New Jersey, Morristown, New Jersey, he was speaking at a conference which was of the LaRouche movement when Mr. LaRouche had just passed away literally 4 days earlier, February 12th. And at that conference, Mr. Binney was seated next to the representative of the Russian mission to the United Nations. And Mr. Binney at that time presented something which the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity had put out back in 2017, July, which is, you want to talk about hoaxes, Russia never hacked the DNC computers. Russia never hacked the DNC computers. And so what, what James was talking about earlier, what Xander mentioned, what other people have mentioned, is we're living in a fucking lie. We're living in a lie that could get us all fried very quickly. And I am not joking about this because, let's see, today's what, Wednesday? 2 days ago, the Russian deputy ambassador, Deputy Foreign Minister Rybakov, said, we're on the verge of a new Caribbean or Cuban missiles crisis. Okay? We're on the verge of a Cuban missiles Caribbean crisis. Now, many of you probably old enough to remember, people got scared shitless because they thought the world was going to go to hell in nuclear war in 1962. And what we're dealing with right now, and I can assert this for fact, there's a dual power situation in the U.S. government. And the best hope we have right now, and the reason I'm going to mention things that have happened just since the 15th of this month, the 15th, the 21st, and the 24th, which is why I'm asserting that everyone should get on the phone to your congressman, burn down the phone lines to get Binney to testify in the Congress that Russia did not hack the DNC. And I'll tell you exactly why right now. And, you know, you can say whatever you want about Trump, you know, you can say whatever you want about anyone, but as a result of this lie that Russia hacked the DNC, the Congress, which has a lot of intelligence people put in there in the last election, they passed a bill under the guise of Russia hacked the DNC that the United States can carry out cyber warfare against Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea without it going through the president. That is, it can go from Congress to the so-called National Security Apparatus of Cyber, U.S. Cyber Command, and Secretary of Defense. So on the 15th, when the New York Times published a lead article saying we're carrying out war against Russia, I repeat, we're carrying out war against Russia, and they won't even tell Trump about it because they say he's going to stop it. That was published in the New York Times. And if people don't realize, if you remember 7 days in May or Dr. Strangelove, this is exactly what we're living through today, you know? And this is not theoretical. This is what's happening. And as I said, Putin on the 13th and Rybakov, the deputy foreign minister on 24th, said, we are 1 inch away from a Cuban missiles crisis. The U.S. has carriers. The U.S. has put in ABM systems in Poland and Romania. The U.S. has been in the Baltic Sea, been in the Black Sea. And, you know, so if people think it can happen, they better think again, because it could happen and it will happen. And that's why the fact that both parties, Democrats and Republicans, even though, quote, Trump didn't collude with Russia, they all say Russia interfered in the U.S. elections. And that's where Binney comes in. The response to allow that big lie to be told is what's allowed this thing to be put in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2019. That means Trump could say, Trump is going to be meeting with Putin for 1 hour on Friday. All of these events, from the 15th, when the New York Times ran that article, to the 21st, when Pompeo and Bolton engineered this confrontation almost leading to war, you know, Trump actually stopped, apparently, it is said, 10 minutes away from launching war on three sites in Iran that would have been incalculable. If anyone thinks, well, it would have been, you know, the old Rand Corporation, they do this, we do this, they do this, and we do this, you know, for 50 steps before it leads to total war, they're morons. They're idiots, because you don't know what's going to be set off. So this is not 17 years ago. This is not John F. Kennedy's time. This is going on right now with the same elements, with the same factors, the same, some cases, the same people, Robert Mueller, the cover-up artist from 9/11. Okay, so the point being, William Binney, now I'm going to read you something you may not know about him, which is, on October 24th, 2017, President Trump, who had contacted Binney after the VIPs put out this report, Russia did not hack the DNC. Binney is the one who knows the NSA. He designed the systems. He knows if Russia hacked the NSA, they'd have all the evidence in the world. They'd have information packets. They'd have tracing numbers, routing numbers. They never produced one shred of this evidence. So Binney, at the direction of President Trump, met with then CIA head William Binney at the CIA headquarters for 1 hour. There were two other CIA people there. And according to what was said, Trump told Pompeo, if you want to know what really happened, talk to Bill Binney. So Trump is one who knows Russia didn't hack the DNC. Trump directed Pompeo to meet with Binney. Binney met with Pompeo. Pompeo said, yes, 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 I'll get some other meetings. We have to get this out. And since that meeting, October 24, 2017, Pompeo has done absolutely zilch. He did not follow up on what he said to Binney. He did nothing. He's perpetuated the Clapper, Comey, Brennan bullshit about Russia because they want confrontation, they want war, and they're going to get war unless the American people, you know, blow the whole house of lies down. Don't chip away at the edge. You got to go for the center of it. And that's, you know, what Lyndon LaRouche was always known for, is to make the policies at the head of state level. You know, Lyndon LaRouche worked with Reagan. Lyndon LaRouche worked with Bill Clinton. Lyndon LaRouche, very well known in Russia. You know, tomorrow night I'll be at the Chinese consulate here in San Francisco, because the Chinese government knows the ones who developed the policy, which is called the Silk Road today, was Lyndon LaRouche. In fact, right before 9/11, we developed a policy. I'm holding the report in my hands. LaRouche calls for new Silk Road as a locomotive for worldwide economic development, dated January 1997. So 9/11 was to blow up the world and prevent cooperation among the nations to replace this bankrupt, derivative infected with speculative bubbles all over the place system, which is going to blow up anyway, even though they bailed it out for 10 years. You know, the whole thing's going to blow up. And through destroying this Russian hoax, blowing the lid on the same people who did the 9/11 hoax, the same people who assassinated Kennedy, King, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, so on down the line, we can get total victory because the American people have been cheated and robbed. The American people have been gypped by this bullshit for years. And if I sound emotional, it's because I am, because I will never accept this. And I don't think any of you should either. And that's conclusion. Binney, we want him to testify in Congress. He's leading a campaign now for the exoneration of Lyndon LaRouche. And by exonerating LaRouche, and that's what I'm asking all of you to support, we have a petition you can sign, you can pass it on. We have a video. Ramsey Clark said LaRouche case was the worst case he ever saw in his whole life. You know, you want to talk about media lies, political lies. It's what happened to Lyndon LaRouche. So by busting that out, Binney and others are working to show Russia, China, and with Trump now on the way to the G8, he took off on the plane today to Japan. He's going to be meeting with Putin 1 hour Friday. He's going to be meeting with Xi Jinping Saturday. We have a chance to make up for all the fuck-ups of the last 50 years and more that have left this country on the verge of going, you know, halfway to hell. But we have a chance. And you know something? If you can never be defeated if you don't stop fighting. You've got to keep fighting, but you have to have a strategy on the level of governments, heads of states, not chipping away on the side, not making a little progress, but these are life and death issues right now. So I'd ask everyone, and I can send you the links, to get Binny to testify in front of Congress. We went all through Congress today. We went through every single senator and House member office. So all your members have the material about Binny, about stopping this war situation, and about the exoneration of LaRouche. So that's my 10 minutes.
All right. Thank you very much, Gerald. Again, let me put us in Q&A mode. Anyone would like to ask a question, star 6 to get on the queue. Okay, so we have a couple of people with questions. We're going to start out with Xander. Go ahead, Xander.
Hey, it's Xander. Hey, Gerald. Sorry I didn't get back to you the other day. Got a lot of stuff going on, get very busy. I really just wanted to say thank you for staying passionate, staying in the game, and bringing us up to speed on some of this background information with Binny and what's going on with that. And that's really all just a comment, not a question.
Okay, thanks, Xander. Okay, and next is Barbara Honegger. Barbara, go ahead. Oh, you're muted. Hang on. Are you muted? Let's see. Issue. No, you're not. Barbara, are you there? All right, so Barbara is on, and she's in Q&A, and she's not muted. So, Barbara, maybe she left her phone for a minute. Okay, so I guess she's not there. So, all right. Any other questions for Gerald? Barbara, are you there? Okay. All right, we're going to skip Barbara then because I don't know where she is. All right, Dan Hennen, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Dan. Dan Hennen again. He's got a good point on all this stuff with this whole Russia collusion, which we knew was a lie from the very beginning, the Russian hacking, which was a lie from the very beginning. Certain outlets and YouTube channels and forums on the Internet are, you know, continually saying this and getting the truth out, but we still get the mainstream media, that's the Fourth Estate, driving home to the American public the lies about this whole collusion, hacking, interfering with the election, all of this nonsense. And I do agree with his point that between Mr. Bolton and Pompeo, they basically took this upon their back to create this false flag. This is just an old blueprint from every other war or conflict we've ever been in. But it was a good presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have a question? So, Gerald, I just wanted to make a comment. This is Cheryl. I read the book by David Korn and Michael, I think Isakoff was his name, like two, you know, liberal, like, journalists, and they supported the official story, and, you know, and then in almost every chapter, at the end of it, they had to say, well, there's only like a 50% chance that what we just said is true, but they write it like it is, and then they put a little caveat at the end to sort of protect themselves, I guess. So, yeah, I think that's all very interesting. I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you for your presentation. Barbara's back. Okay, let's go. Barbara, you have a question?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, great. Yeah, I was actually, I could hear you say that I wasn't there, but I was there before.
Oh.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
I fully agree with everything that has been said here. I would like people to know, though, that Thomas Drake was also very high up in the NSA. He has great expertise like Bill Binney, and he disagrees with Bill Binney. I think that's important for people to know. If you're interested in their debate, Bill Drake or Thomas Drake does not agree that with Bill Binney's analysis, where Binney concludes that it had to have been an inside job with a download onto something like a thumb drive at the DNC, and therefore the Russians couldn't do it. Thomas Drake disagrees. But I would like to say that even if Bill Binney is correct, that it doesn't change the fact that there were 140 meetings between the topmost Trump campaign officials and the Russians or Russian-linked individuals, and that the Trump and his campaign people lied about all 140 of them. So even if Bill Binney is correct, that's not the whole story. So I just wanted to make that point. That's it.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Gerald, did you want to respond?
He might be on mute.
Oh, he's on mute here.
Okay, Gerald, can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Okay, no problem. First of all, on the question of Binney's expertise in this, et cetera, there's a case now involving Roger Stone in which he's charged with collusion with WikiLeaks and with Russia. And Roger Stone had Bill Binney come in and give a deposition and said, it's not possible that I colluded with Russia because they hacked the DNC, et cetera, et cetera. So you show me the proof. You show me the proof. If you charge me with that, you show me the proof Russia hacked the DNC. That's going on right now. There was a hearing on that last Friday. Okay? The government came back, the U.S. government came back and said, it's true. They never took possession. So no matter what Thomas Drake says or Bill Binney or anyone else says, the fact of the matter is that government never took possession of those computers. How do you investigate a crime if you don't go to the scene of the crime and get the evidence? They didn't do it. The FBI didn't do it. The DOJ didn't do it. They admitted that. They said they actually relied on a company called CrowdStrike, which was a DNC cyber company, CrowdStrike. Remember that name, CrowdStrike, because the people in CrowdStrike gave a draft memo to the FBI. And so Mr. Stone said, I want to see their whole report. I want to see their forensics. I want to see all their evidence. I don't want to see a draft report. What kind of bullshit is this, a draft report? So the government came back. This is a fact you haven't seen in the media. CrowdStrike never did a full report. They never actually did it. So they don't have it. So there's no evidence. So whatever Thomas Drake says or Bill Binney says or any Barbara Honegger says, there is no evidence. So we're going to have World War III over no evidence. So if anyone is willing to accept that, they're out of their minds. But that's what this country has come to. People accept bullshit. They don't look into it. Okay? So that's my point. Number two, there's nothing wrong with having good relationships with Russia. Anyone remember World War II? Anyone know anything about Trump's uncle, John Trump? No. John Trump was one of the scientists and development radar and actually taught Donald Trump to hate nuclear war when he was 15 years old during the Kennedy missile crisis. Trump was young. So if you look at Donald Trump's statements about his Uncle John, that's all you need to know. Donald Trump is trying to stop war. You know, I lived in New York. I know what New York is. Okay? And God bless his soul that he's trying to stop nuclear war. And if anyone is foolish enough to play with the British and to play with the people who want to keep the world in a constant state of perpetual war, they're out of their mind, because these people will blow up the world or threaten to blow up the world to get people to go along with financial usurious system, which is bankrupt. And that's where LaRouche comes in. Not Donald Trump, LaRouche. LaRouche designed a new system. And we got people in Russia, like Glazyev, advisor to Putin, who agree with LaRouche, like China, agree with LaRouche on this new system, which is called the Bretton Woods. Low interest credit for development, joint projects between the U.S. and China in Africa, in South America, so people don't have to leave their homes. So they can have infrastructure, water, power, agriculture. That, if that comes out of the G20 meeting, that the U.S. is going to cooperate with China, with Russia, with the Belt and Road, New Silk Road, which is LaRouche design, then the ball game is over for the globalists. We should have had this new system a long time ago instead of bailing out the bullshit offshore British financial speculative Wall Street bubble. That's the issue right there. And if Binney can get in front of Congress and show the forensics, even if Thomas Drake disagrees, and if this comes out that they never did the study, that they were spying like hell, they were spying on everyone, which Binney knows they were, then maybe the American people can rise to the occasion and actually, and that movie on Binney is called A Good American. People should watch it. He's someone who's willing to stand on principles and have a gun pulled in his head by Mueller, you know, a little punk Mueller who's been getting away with bullshit for far too long.
Gerald,
so,
we have one more question for you. Can we go on?
Sure,
to that?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay. Sherry, you're up. Go ahead.
This is Sherry in San Diego. I just disagree with you because believe that all of this, everything that you kind of just said is just a distraction that our country was taken over on 9/11, 2001, and those criminals are still very much in charge. Donald Trump has made the world more dangerous and closer to nuclear annihilation of planet Earth than ever in history. The doomsday clock, which I keep abreast of because I get their bulletins and read it, has been moved twice since he was appointed the ruler. And that's never happened ever before. So these guys know what they're doing. They're not politicians. They're nuclear scientists. And they just named a town Trump Heights in Golan Heights. And they just minted coins with Trump's face on it in Israel. He's under the complete control of the Zionists that have been running our country for a very long time. And, you know, they're in all of our powerful positions. All you have to know is about Rabbi Dove Zakheim. That violates Section 401E of the 1940 Nationality Act that says you can't have dual citizens in the United States government. So we've already been taken over. We've got, we've got a guy on the Supreme Court who's an actual 9/11 criminal, Kavanaugh. He was Bush's right-hand man writing torture policies. His wife was Bush's secretary. I mean, we have Mr. and Mrs. 9/11 on the Supreme Court. If a case came before him about 9/11 and something had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court from our incredible lawyers committee, he couldn't tell the truth because he would be implicating himself. So we're really effed up bad. And all of this stuff is just a distraction. That's what I believe.
Okay, Sherry, let me just tell you something about the people you mentioned that you got this information from. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. I used to live in Chicago. I went through their archives from when the magazine was founded. I knew one of the founding members of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project, who was a friend, a member of the LaRouche movement. And the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, you can check it out if you wish. Published material, and our friend resigned from it in one of their early publications, I believe it was 1946 issue, by Bertrand Russell, Lord Bertrand Russell, calling for preventative atomic war against Russia. He called for bombing Russia with a atomic weapon because he said Russia didn't have it yet. And he said that would be the basis of world government. That's what they were pushing for, world government and preventative nuclear war against Russia, bomb Russia back to the Stone Age before they would develop, you know, some kind of atomic or hydrogen bomb. So last point, the bulletin of atomic scientists is a rag full of shit. To put it bluntly.
It was founded in 1945 by the University of Chicago scientists who had helped develop the first atomic weapons in the Manhattan Project. The bulletin.
Yes, I know them. I know them. I toured it. They gave me a tour of it. I know exactly where it is. I was there. I lived there for 30 years.
I mean, their board of sponsors includes 15 Nobel laureates. I mean, I disagree. I think that's a pretty respectable group. So, and I think we're in big trouble.
Okay.
And all this stuff's just bullshit.
All right.
You know, and
no
Trump
problem.
Is, and
no
I
problem.
Okay, so you both agree that we're in big trouble, just looking at it from different points of view.
Okay.
Great. And we have one last question here from Ann. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. This is Ann again. Could
sure.
you tell us your perspective of why 9/11 truth has not succeeded? Why have we not succeeded in getting the message out to the American population? What's your perspective?
I put it to you this way. I thought about that question right before the call. I was thinking, I've never seen people as, you know, so dedicated as yourselves. I've listened to a few of these calls. I was on a call a couple of years ago, and it's just, it's difficult to deal with the fact of something that happened 17, 18 years ago. That's what makes it hard, even though the obvious point is these people who carried out 9/11, and what I'm trying to get across, you know, with the exoneration of LaRouche and with this destroying the Russiagate hoax, is you will be destroying the people who carried out 9/11. So that if you really are committed, and I believe you guys really are in unbelievable ways, it takes a tremendous amount of dedication to stick with this. And, you know, but I'm saying you got to think. 17 years ago, versus we're facing war right now by the same people who did the 9/11 hoax. So what you got to realize is that it is difficult to get people to look back when what they're facing right now is already the consequences of them not having done what they should have done 18, 17, 16, 15, 14 years ago. But the psychology of it is that's past. Here we are facing a situation of a dual power of being 10 minutes away from possible nuclear or beginning of war that could escalate. Warnings from the Russian government, from Putin, you know, from Rybakov. The Chinese government just wrote a huge article attacking Pompeo, okay? So if you tell people, if you want to get to the bottom of 9/11, then we got to go after the bastards like Pompeo, Bolton, etc., that are running a dual power situation, just like, go back and watch 7 Days in May. You know, the president in the 7 Days in May, which was at the time of Kennedy, people earlier pointed out, Kennedy wanted to have an agreement negotiated with Khrushchev. In fact, what is so against Trump talking to Russia? If Kennedy hadn't been talking to Khrushchev, which mostly had to do with back channels, because the media was so full of shit then. So it is these discussions with other countries on the basis of coming up with a policy for mutual good for the whole world, because we're dealing with this establishment, which is the old empire mindset. They are brainwashing the population to not know which end is up. So therefore, it takes leadership, and the leadership that gets viciously attacked by the media is usually the people who are telling the truth. In other words, if popular opinion is a lie, you need someone like LaRouche who's willing to stand up to popular opinion and not bend down to popular opinion. So in my view, Binney and people like this who did call out on 9/11, they're the real heroes. The people who fought for 9/11 truth, they are the heroes. But you can't live on your glories of the past. You got to get into the situation of today and what you want for the future. Cooperation, the new Silk Road, joint projects, bring people up. China's brought 700 million people out of poverty. China's built 30,000 kilometers of high-speed rail since 2008. We have zero. It's not because China stole the technology from us, like Pompeo and Bolton are saying. How could China steal the technology from us when we don't even have it? You know, it's you got to go on a flank. You got to outflank it. You can't just try to keep butting your head, you know, like a Marine who charges out and gets shot. But they show, oh, how I'm brave, I got shot. No, outflank it. Always go for the flank. So this cooperation with China, with Russia, economic development, third world development, that's what we, LaRouche Pack, is going to get Trump to do, whether he likes it or not, because we got the support of 3 billion people around the world who want a better life for the future. And they're sick and tired of these wars. You know, that Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was Franklin Roosevelt fought Churchill in the conferences during World War II. We're going to get rid of the British Empire at the end of World War II, end all colonialism. Franklin Roosevelt died, and Truman and the whole gang got taken over, and they pushed the idea of the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, the Afghanistan War, all the wars was because we didn't adopt the anti-colonial approach that FDR was pushing for at the end of the war. And Lyndon LaRouche, at that time, was in India at 22 years old, and he saw the British firsthand massacring Indians, killing them in cold blood for the crime of wanting to be an independent nation. And Lyndon LaRouche said, I will always fight for the anti-colonialists, for the pro-development approach. So that's the spirit that America has got to recapture, is to ally with development and not with this British fop Wall Street, you know, globalist order of garbage that's left out. Look at the suicide rate in the U.S. Look at the drug rate. Look at the alcohol rate, divorce rate. This is a rotting hell in the United States. Go to San Francisco. Walk over the bodies on the streets, the drugs on the streets, the garbage on the streets. You know, what kind of country is this? Yes,
Daryl?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think any of us would argue with you on most of what you're saying there. I want to thank you for your presentation. And
okay, no problem.
So,
I thank everyone. I thank everyone. I enjoy being challenged. It's not a problem. And just exonerate LaRouche, sign the petition, and get Binney to testify, and it'll go a long way towards dealing with all the things that have been discussed.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And next on our agenda is Barbara Honegger is going to share with us to the Denver conference back in May. So, Barbara, are you still with us?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can now.
I just got unmuted. Okay. I would just like to make one comment to the comment that was made about my comment before I talk about the Denver conference. And that is, I don't really think it's fair to say you know, what Barbara Honegger says. I was simply letting you know that Thomas Drake, who was treated as vilely as Bill Binney by the United States government, and I believe he was, there was a SWAT team that came and arrested him before Bill Binney, he disagrees with Bill Binney on his analysis about the DNC downward. I just want people to know that. Okay. So it's not my opinion, just, you know, look up the debate between the two. I would like people to know also, very, very important, before I talk about the Denver conference, there's been a major development. This is mind-bogglingly positive. Two mind-bogglingly positive developments for 9/11 truth. The first one is, I don't know how many of you know Lucy Morgan Edwards. She was the moderator for the Left Out Forum, where Kevin Barrett, myself, and Richard Gage spoke a couple of years ago, or maybe 3 years ago now. Anyway, I think it was 2 years ago in New York City. And she was the British government advisor on politics to the Afghan government for a while. So in any case, that's who she is. Well, she's very highly connected in the UK. And I think it's now been about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago, that she went to a public event at Bletchley Park, which is the equivalent of the NSA in our country. And during one of the breaks, she was talking to a man who she assumed he wasn't a very large person, and it was obviously he had military bearing. I don't know if he was wearing a military uniform. I believe he was, but she thought he was some kind of low-level or mid-ranking member of the United States military. So she struck up a conversation at the, you know, at the wine table or whatever. And it wasn't long before she mentioned 9/11, and she wanted to know if this person was, they'd already exchanged a few comments. She wanted to know, because he said, what do you do? And she said, well, I'm really full-time on 9/11 Truth. And she wanted to know if he was aware of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiries grand jury petition on the World Trade Center and the FBI lawsuits in the D.C. federal court. And this person said to her, well, do you think something will come of it? And it was obvious from the way he said it that he was in favor of what we are doing. Well, it turns out that this was none other than Admiral Mike Rogers, the just until last December head of the National Security Agency. Okay? So she has his contact information, and she's going to be following this up. They weren't able to speak anymore, but he made it very, very clear that he's with us. And I find that fascinating. I think it's extremely important. The other really positive development is yesterday I was on the monthly 9/11 Truth Action Project, the 9/11 Tap Call for Europe, and it is moderated and led by Jan van Eyken, who was Richard Gage's and my host for our joint speaking tour last May, a year ago in May, in Europe and London. And he announced at the event something quite amazing. Well, actually, there was someone who came on the call. I can't remember his name, but he's a 9/11 Truth person who has lived for years in Japan, speaks fluent Japanese and English, of course. I believe he's American. I'm double-checking this. But in any case, he came on the call late, and so he was invited to say anything important that had happened as an update, and he said, well, yes, there's a major development that he personally has been in contact just very recently, like within the last week, week and a half, with a major documentarian who produces video content for mainstream television channels and networks in Japan. There are three or four mainstream television networks or channels, and this company, whose name he gave, I can't remember at the moment, but they are contracted by the mainstream television networks and channels to do their content. And they are actively working on a documentary on 9/11 Truth in a very positive and open-minded way. They've already contacted architects and engineers, and this person who was on the call, who lives in Japan, who knows this person, the head of this company, who talked to him about it, he said he was told that their motivation, that what got them finally to take this seriously and to do a serious documentary on it for mainstream television in Japan in the hopeful near future, assuming the networks accept it, which is a big question mark, but hopefully they will, but they are producing this documentary, that their motivation for finally doing this and taking it seriously was when they learned of the Lawyers Committee filing of the grand jury petition in New York City on the World Trade Center. So the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers is in communication with this group. And that's, you know, potentially a major breakthrough, because if it gets on mainstream television in Japan, we can then get that video and put it on YouTube and get it to our own mainstream television networks and channels, as well as alternatives, as well as alternative outlets. So that's hopefully offing in the near future. So I just wanted to let everybody know those two big developments. They're very exciting. Okay, so I know everybody has lots of questions that I look forward to answering about the Denver conference. There are some highlights that really struck home to me that that I want to share with you before I open it up to Q's and A's. So that was on May 4th. It was in Denver, Colorado. I'm guesstimating there were 40 people there. It was in a large room, and there were hardly any chairs filled with people, but nevertheless, the hardcore was there. As you already know, no one was allowed to be part of the program who would even question the official story light of all of the speakers who gave presentations. The first presentation, as I recall, was by Wayne Coste, and then by John Wyndham, and then I believe it was by, after John Wyndham, I believe it was Warren Stutt, and then there was Ken Jenkins, and of course there was David Chandler. I think David Chandler was number two. But they started the conference. Fran Schur was the MC of the conference. Now, many of you have already seen the videos of the different sections of the conference are on the web. You can go to scientistsfor911truth.org, I think it is. It's .com or .org, I think it's .org. And you'll have the links to the different sections of the conference. Now, the videotape of the conference, Ken Jenkins took possession of that videotape. And because I've gone to the conference, I haven't yet had a chance. I just got back from Richard Gage's wonderful wedding in Idaho this Sunday, and so I just haven't had a chance preparing for that and going to it and getting back and recuperating. I haven't had a chance to actually look at what Ken Jenkins has allowed to be seen of the videotape. I believe that he has probably edited out my comments and comments about me and my work, but that remains to be seen. But you can see either the full or more likely edited sections of the conference online. So you could go to scientistsfor911truth.org for that. So they, Fran Schur opened the conference. She was the moderator. And to give her credit, she did mention right close to the outset that I had personally done with Hamuk, videographer Hamuk, who has 911tv.org, that we had done a rebuttal to the 36-minute, 35-and-a-half-minute summary video of Coste and Chandler that they opened the conference with. They played the whole 35-and-a-half minutes to open the conference, and they had announced this in advance, so I have done, and I did, before the conference, a rebuttal video, and I made DVDs of it. They were free, and they were passed out to everyone at the conference, including the speakers, and of course, Fran Schur. So she did mention that they were free at the back of the room, but I didn't let people just go to the back of the room. I passed them out individually to everybody. But she did mention that they were there and that she was glad that I had made it and that she encouraged everyone to watch it. So that was fair. That was fair. She then opened the conference with some, housekeeping. And the first person that she introduced was Wayne Coste. And she made it clear where she comes down, she called Wayne Coste a hero for having done his video, which, of course, I rebutted, and most of us on this call do not agree with. So it's clear where she comes down. Now, people need to understand that she's now a couple with David Candler. They have bought a house together in Denver. So that can go someplace towards explaining where she's coming from these days. But anyway, the substance that was important to me, now you can watch the videos, and I highly encourage everyone to watch the video of the conference. Well, first off, to watch my rebuttal video. And I'm going to be sending that link again to be put with the minutes for this segment of this call. So my rebuttal video is about 2.5 hours. The last 35 and a half minutes of it, so you don't have to find it online, is the Coste Chandler summary video that I rebut in the first part of my video, which is also on YouTube, and I will give the link to that. So it's very important to watch the rebuttal video and their 35 and a half minute summary video that I rebut. I take my had my videographer home up, take the slides from their video, their summary video of their official story light position, and I insert those into my rebuttal video and then rebut them. So you don't have to watch their video first. You get their slides in my rebuttal video. But then at the end, if you want to watch theirs, you can see it in the last third or so of my rebuttal video. I just copied their 35 and a half minute video that they opened the Denver class with. So to me, the most important thing that happened at the conference was that all of the speakers, of course, pushed the official story light. Now, what do I mean by official story light? I make it very clear in my rebuttal video that by official story light, this group of people are trying to get us to believe that everything about the official story at the Pentagon is true, except for, they admit, that that Hani Hanjour probably wasn't in control of the plane, certainly in the last few minutes, and that, therefore, the plane could well have been remote controlled. That's the sole exception to the official story that they will grant. That's it. So as far as I'm concerned, that's the official story. But I call it official story light because of that exception. So every single one of these speakers, you can see their presentations for yourself on the Internet, the videos from the conference, they all push official story light. Now, the most important speaker to me was Warren Stutz. They brought him in all the way from New Zealand. And I actually admire and trust Warren Stutz. Warren Stutz is not an ideologue like the others are. Warren Stutz is an FDR digital analyst. He's a digital analyst. And after the conference was over, everyone who was there was invited to go to Graham's Tour and David Chandler's house for what they called a, quote, continuation of the discussion. There, of course, was no discussion. It was totally one-sided, so that was a misnomer. But once Bonnie Faulkner and I went with Bonnie Faulkner to the conference, when Bonnie Faulkner and I got to Fran Schur and David Chandler's house, there was a dining room table. And I sat down next to Wayne Coste on my left. I was at the end of the table. Wayne Coste was on my left. David Chandler was on my right. And on David Chandler's side of the table, just beyond him, was Warren Stutz. And Bonnie was sitting there. Those were those of us at the table for at least the first hour and a half or 2 hours. And I held a knockdown, drag-out debate with these people. Okay? Point by point, we each had our laptops open. I showed them point by point in my rebuttal, and they tried to argue back. All right? So we had an actual debate at that table, which is exactly what should have happened at the conference, and they didn't allow it. So that's the first interesting thing. The most important fact that I learned at that table, and I learned it from Warren Stutz, and Chandler and Coste then acknowledged it. And that is, maybe some of you know this, but I didn't. It turns out that Warren Stutz, being the alleged Flight 77 FDR analyst. Okay, this FDR that was allegedly found inside the Pentagon rubble, just inside the alleged C-ring exit hole, which is not even the right kind. The black boxes are not the right kind for any 757 of any American Airlines on 9/11. We know that from American Airlines' own press release put out right after the alleged FDR was allegedly recovered from the rubble. Nevertheless, Stutt has this data, and he has analyzed it. What I learned from Stutt at the table, which blew my mind, and he said that the actual data, that the path of the plane, that is a plane in the data of the alleged FDR, putting aside whether it's an actual FDR of Flight 77, that it is a north path, not a south path. And that Chandler and Coste, the words that they use is they adjust, quote, adjust for data drift. Adjust for data drift from the actual north path, north of Citgo Pass, that they alleged, in their words, adjust for drift to forfeit it into a south path, an official story path. And I almost fell off my chair when I learned that. And I shouted it out. There were only the five or six of us at the table at that point, and I shouted it out for the entire house to hear. There were people in the kitchen, there were people outside, there were people in the living room. And once I shouted this out, lots of people came, including Fran Schur, and other people around the table, Chris Sarnes and others. There were other things that that Warren Stutt said at the table that shocked Chris Sarnes and David Chandler and Constance. And one of them is that according to his analysis, and he has to, again, make some, quote, adjustments, unquote, based upon, quote, assumptions, unquote, from the actual alleged FDR data. But when Warren Stutt does this, and it's important to know that all of these people in the official storylight cabal, they all rely upon Stutt's analysis, every one of them. Stutt said that according to his analysis, after, quote, adjustments, unquote, for certain, quote, assumptions, unquote, that the bottom of the fuselage, according to the data on this alleged FDR, that the bottom of the fuselage was about 4 feet off the ground. Well, there's a problem with that. And you have to understand that when you carefully look at what they're saying, their entire claims fail if they can't effectively prove, and they can't, that the entire 757, with a minor exception, has to get into the ground floor. The ground floor is only 14 to 14 and a half feet high. So Warren Stutt said the very lowest, that the bottom of the fuselage itself, according to his analysis with the assumptions and the adjustments, is 4 feet off the ground at the point of alleged impact. The massive 6-ton steel and titanium engines hang down 4.5 feet below the bottom of the fuselage. They would be on the ground. They would gouge at least one of them, because the plane allegedly came in, according to the official story, at an angle, so that the left wing was further down than the right wing. At a very minimum, there would be a gouge. It's not enough to have that little bit out of the not very tall concrete wall. It would, that steel and titanium engine of the left engine would have absolutely gouged the ground if Warren Stutt's analysis of the very bottom, the very lowest that the bottom of the fuselage could have been, was 4 feet off the ground. So anyway, the bottom line is I trust Warren Stutt. And what I'm now doing, based upon everything, all of my notes from the Denver conference, I'm now doing an update, an upgrade, an update of the rebuttal video, And I'm going to be putting that online. Hopefully it'll be in the next week to 10 days. And I will let everybody know when it's up. And I will let you know where the changes or additions are, so you don't have to watch it all over again. So I'm going to be doing that. I think that, there was another major event in from my point of view, and that is that John Wyndham has, I don't know if people are aware of this, but Craig McKee has mentioned it on previous calls. It is a fact of history about this group that they came together to do the alleged rebuttal of my Behind the Smoke Curtain. It was to try to counter my work that they came together in the first place. And John Wyndham is the main author of that paper, which you learn if you read the footnote on page one. It's called the Ashley et al. Paper, but it's the John Wyndham paper. John Wyndham was one of the speakers, and he is a very dishonest person. His presentation was to present a paper that he's already published years ago that presumes to compare and contrast the official story of a large plane hitting where the official story says when the official story says at column 14 in the West Wedge. He basically presented that same paper, comparing and contrasting official story light with all of the other alleged theories, and completely misrepresented what's in Behind the Smoke Curtain, claiming that it was only explosives. Of course, that's not true. Behind the Smoke Curtain is a plane, yes, smaller than a 757, not at the time or the place on the wall that the official story claims, plus pre-placed explosives. The other main comment that kind of gives the bottom line of why did they do this, one of the Q's and A's, and you can see the Q's and A's, the panel with the Q's and A's, that's also on scientist11truth.org, that video segment. There were a few questions, and the question, one of those questions to the panel was, why are you doing this now? And Ken Jenkins answered that question. And to my surprise, he answered it honestly. What he said was, words to the effect, as, you know, as verbatim as I can remember, but you'll see it for yourself on the video. He said, well, you know, this is getting serious because of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Of course, I was the only board member of the Lawyers Committee present at the conference. And he said, well, it's because this is getting serious with what the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry is doing. And they've already had the grand jury petition in New York City for the World Trade Center, and they will probably have one on the Pentagon, and it's important that we influence what the Lawyers Committee does on the Pentagon. Well, I knew that's what they were about, and that's the reason that they focus on me. They're scared to death that I'm on the Lawyers Committee board, and they should be. The other thing that Ken Jenkins said that was very revealing, extremely revealing, and I want to give a little context to what he said first. I want to remind people, and I've said this on the call before, that the Pentagon has controversy over the plane, or lack thereof, or flyover, or when it hit, or where it hit. There's debate. Yes, there is. But there's also equal controversy over especially the second plane at World Trade Center 2 in New York City. But architects and engineers and Richard Gage never talk about the plane, and they're wise not to. They focus only on what really matters, which is the proof of pre-placed explosives. That is the main finding and evidence in Behind the Smoke Curtain. That is what matters. And my recommendation to the Lawyers Committee is and will be on the board and on the petition drafting committee, that we do as Richard Gage and Architects and Engineers have done, and their success is their laser focus on the pre-placed explosives prior to even any of the planes hitting either tower. Same thing at the Pentagon. Now, that is what makes strategic sense. And guess what? when you listen or watch the video of the panel discussion in response to a question, Ken Jenkins, measly mouth, he almost mumbles it, so you might have to turn up the volume, but he actually says that what's important when we get to the Lawyers Committee and we move forward with the Pentagon is that they focus on the Pentagon plane and they denigrate all the evidence, which is overwhelming and compelling, for pre-placed explosives at the Pentagon. They want to do exactly the opposite of what every one of those members of that cabal do for the World Trade Center. They want to change it 180 degrees at the Pentagon, and it's unwise, it's unstrategic, and I won't stand for it on the Lawyers Committee. So I'm open to questions.
Okay, so great. Let me put us into Q&A here. Oh, whoops. Okay, so if you'd like to ask the question again, it's star six.
Since no one's in yet, can I jump? Go ahead,
sure,
Carol.
Sure, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, this is Craig. There's so much one could bring up about this, but I'll zero in on a couple of quick things. Just one point of clarification, Barbara, when you mentioned about how the group came together to do this paper rebutting your work. What I had said in the past was that was the time when they publicly acknowledged that they were together, working together as a group, whereas my contention was going back to 2010, 2011, when I first started writing about it, was that they were working together the whole time and just more or less pretending that they weren't by kind of recommending each other's work back and forth and pretending they were all independent of each other. So it was just when they put all their names on that paper in 2016, that was kind of when they confirmed that they were in fact operating as a group. So you could, feel free to comment on that, but I'll give you this at the same time. I 100% agree with you about the Lawyers Committee. This is exactly, I'm hearing this creep in, even some of the little trolls that run around agreeing with them on Facebook are throwing this out now about, well, if we're going to go to a court of law, then we have to be credible. So this court of law thing just keeps popping in everywhere now, and it seems very artificial to me. But the thing I wanted to raise specifically with you was the comment, and I don't know if you heard Jenkins say this, but he made a comment about David Ray Griffin, that his position had been shifting and is continuing to shift on the question of a large plane impact at the Pentagon. This is not true. Unless it's a very recent phenomenon. What Jenkins is talking about, of course, is the consensus approach that Griffin took in 2011, where he basically said, let's forget about whether something hit the building and let's focus on it. It couldn't have been Al-Qaeda. But he's implying, Jenkins is telling people that Griffin is shifting away from a no-impact position, and this is just false. And I've written to Jenkins and gotten a response back, and I'm going to be responding back to him again. But anyway, I wondered if that was something you wanted to comment on. And that's all I've got.
Okay, Barbara may be muted. Yes, she is. Hang on, Barbara.
Yeah, if you could keep me unmuted, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to comment on a few. You're absolutely right, your first comment. That's what I meant. I just used shorthand. There's no question that these people were working together behind the scenes, pretending that they were individuals who, their common statement as well. A perfect example is Dwayne Dietz and Wayne Kostick, and they're latecomers, right, to this, and they're long. It's almost scripted, or if not, I think it is scripted. Well, when I, really spent a lot of time and I looked at it further, I realized that the official story is really true. Okay. So you're absolutely right. They were doing this individually all along, and it was the Ashley et al. Paper that was really written by John Wyndham, which completely misrepresents my position in Smoke Curtain, and he knows he does. He really was guilty at this conference. When he, from the podium, when he was asked in the Q&A session, if Ken Jenkins hasn't edited it out, I'll be very surprised. But in the Q&As, we were only allowed one question on a card. And my card, which Fran Schur did read, was that I objected. I was publicly objecting to his gross misstatement that my position was explosives only. And he gives this, this response, well, it really is explosives only. No, it isn't explosives only. He is lying. But the interesting thing to me about the interaction in the panel was that Wyndham is the main author of that paper, and he was really the one who kind of orchestrated going public as a group, and it was with the paper that attacked my work. But you're absolutely right. They were doing this individually beforehand. I just find it fascinating that they chose my work to do that, and I do believe that it has to do with the fact that even then I was working on the grand jury petition, getting ready for the grand jury petition with the pre-lawyers committee. Anyway, so that's the comment. You're absolutely right about that. But I do want to comment about what Ken Jenkins said about David Ray Griffin's allegedly shifting position on the Pentagon attack. The way I was there, and I, as I said, I have to watch the actual video, but the, what I thought he was referring to, Ken Jenkins, in answer to that question, in the panel discussion at the end, what I thought he was referring to was when Ken Jenkins, as I believe you know, had an exclusive to be David Ray Griffin's videographer. And David Ray Griffin gave a presentation in which he took a position that was not the position that these people take. Now, I don't know what position David Ray Griffin took then, but it was one they didn't like. So we have to infer in this public address that only Ken Jenkins has the whole video of, okay, David Ray Griffin took a position that Ken Jenkins called him up and argued him out of leaving in his own video, and Ken Jenkins then edited it out. Now, that's my understanding of the context of his saying that David Ray Griffin has shifting positions. I will tell you this, though. Just to be fair, I don't know David Ray Griffin's final position. I do know that in his New Pearl Harbor Revisited, which I believe was his 10th anniversary book, I believe that it's in that book that he basically, what as you said, I think it's that book where he says, you know, we really need to not be focusing on the question about the plane, which is the strategic thing to do. It's unwise to focus on the planes at either the World Trade Center or at the Pentagon, period. So David's right about that. However, David has sent me an email in relation to the Consensus Project. The Consensus Project asked me to propose Pentagon points. I have not done that because I didn't think that it was appropriate. He and Elizabeth got to me some years ago, I would say 3 years ago now maybe four, three and a half anyway, and said that it's rare that we do this, but for someone who has true expertise, who is not one of our 23 or whatever Consensus Project members on the jury, that the one or both of them, Elizabeth or David, reach out and ask people with expertise in an area of 9/11 to propose points and evidence therefrom, therefore, and then if the two of them consider them viable, then they will propose them to the group. And I've not done that to date, maybe I will, that I have an open invitation to do that. But it was in the context of this back and forth that David sent me an email, which I have kept, in which he says that he believes that the preponderance of evidence does favor a large plane at the Pentagon. He didn't say at the official story time or at the official story place, because smoke curtain itself supports a rather large plane, just not Flight 77 and not a Boeing American Airlines 757. So I don't really know what's behind his thinking, but you might be wrong about your position on David Ray Griffin. I have that in an email.
How recent would that email be?
As I said, about 3 to 3.5 years ago.
Because when I was interacting with him, when I was creating my no 757 list, he was quite clear that he did not believe a 757 impacted the building. So that's more recent. That's a little over a year ago.
But let me clarify. I didn't say that. He doesn't say that a 757 hit the building. He understands the evidence in smoke curtain that it could not have been, according to American Airlines' own press release of September 14, 2001, it could not have been any of their, from the FDR and from the flight data recorders and the cockpit voice recorder, it could not have been from any of their American Airlines 757s on 9/11. So he knows that. So when he says no 757, I believe that's what he's basing that on. You'd have to ask him. But he has sent me an email that he does believe that the preponderance of evidence is that there was a large plane destroyed at the Pentagon, which is smoke curtain.
I would love to see his words on that, because that's not what I understand him to support.
I will read it to you. I do not feel it was sent to me in confidence. I will be happy to read it to you over the phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we have some people queued up to ask questions. Can we go to them now? Are you done,
yeah.
Greg?
Yep. Oh, yeah, of course, sure.
Yeah. Okay, great. So Marty Hopper, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Barbara, it's Marty.
Hi, yeah.
Hi, so it's Marty Hopper in Colorado, and I'm on the leadership team of Colorado 9/11 Truth that hosted the conference that Barbara's talking about. And just, first of all, Barbara, I want to thank you for coming out to you and Bonnie, because I thought that was great that you came out, because that's how we're going to move forward, you know, talking to each other. Also, I just want to say that personally I don't have an opinion about what happened at the Pentagon. I think it requires a great deal of study, and I have not put the time into it. So I don't have a comment about what happened or which theory is correct. So the point of my comment is, one, just to encourage people, and I appreciate, Barbara, you're referring people to the website, is to look at the evidence for themselves. You could all do that and make your own decisions, and kind of in the spirit of moving forward together in science, that's what I would encourage people. It is a scientist for 9/11 Truth. It is, by the way, barbara.com, so, you know.
.com.
And if folks are doing this, once you get there, you'll see something that says 9/11 Pentagon Study Group, and you click on that, and that's what will take you to the videos. It's free, so you can watch them for yourselves. And you will also see on the website a letter of support from Dr. Stephen Jones, whom we all know, the physicist. And there's a letter there. A couple of things he says is, one, he says, quote, "I encourage you to study the available evidence with an open mind, comma, as I have done." He also says, "Based on my own studies of photographic evidence, I have found that considerable damage is indeed found on either side of the entry hole, consistent with the wingspan of a B-757 jet. There is a great deal yet to be learned about the Pentagon hit.
and I now plan to listen to and study the video recordings of the proceedings of this conference, and I urge you to do likewise. So those are some of his, there's more there that's actually quite interesting about what he says about Cheney and Norman Mineta, so folks can go there and read that. I'm not going to, obviously don't want to take the time to read all that, but so just encouraging people to look at the evidence, make their decisions, quite fascinating. And also, Barbara, just a personal appeal is I feel what I would say the name-calling is not helpful. I mean, calling this group, I hear you strongly disagree with their analysis, but, you know, calling them official story light cabal, I mean, that is not helpful. I find it somewhat alarming. I mean, a cabal is a people who are secretly, you know, united in some kind of plot.
Believe that they are, Marty.
saying that they're lying, that they're ideologues. This kind of, I just would ask you not do that. I don't think that's helpful to us moving forward.
Well, you need to understand that they do the same. I don't know if you've seen what Chandler's been saying recently. It's horrible.
Okay, well, I can't speak to that. I'm just making a comment to you because of what I'm hearing you say and just an appeal to you directly. So that's all
okay.
I have to say.
All right.
Thank you, Marty. Dan Hennen, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Dan Hennen. I wanted to thank Barbara for coming on and presenting this. This is good, very good info, I think, and it's very telling of what we're dealing with here within the 9/11 Truth community. And it is the good guys versus the bad guys. I myself started to fall away from this monthly teleconference over the last couple of years. And once Wayne Kosky left, I was, you know, feeling much better about the teleconference, but boy, when Ken Jenkins resigned from this group, it's
Ken
been
Freeland.
180 to Ken was it Freeland?
Freeland, yes.
Yeah, it's
Ken
been
Freeland.
Really it's really good. I'm back encouraged and coming on to this show, and I think that Craig and Cheryl have done a good job on this monthly call because it is. Very good and very refreshing now to have some fresh faces out there. I do agree with Barbara Honegger in the fact that rather than keeping these folks' names hidden, it is better and more effective to call out these folks that are within this group. And we need to move forward and expose these people in this, what I agree with, is a cabal. And we need to expose these folks. So thanks again, Barbara, and thanks for Cheryl and Craig. Over.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Okay. Peter Ketchum,
yes,
you're next. Go ahead. Peter, are
Hello?
You on mute?
Yes.
Hi, Peter. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I have a question, and I'll try and ask this as delicately as I can because it's about it's really about behavior. So when I, you know, first started getting involved in 2016 with Architects and Engineers, you know, I did have some conversations with David Chandler. He contacted me, and I had seen some of his videos specifically about Building 7 and some of the analysis he did about the acceleration and how he really challenged NIST on that piece and got NIST to change their report on, you know, on a real critical piece.
Yes.
And I found him very reasonable to talk to, and I thought his videos that he had did on the collapses were very, very well done.
They were.
And then when I see David Chandler, his involvement with the Pentagon, which I admit I don't know, my focus has been almost entirely on NIST and the World Trade Center. So the Pentagon I just don't know as much about. But it's almost like there's two David Chandlers. You know, on the,
exactly.
He doesn't... He seems to be very even-handed when it comes to World Trade Center, but when it comes to the Pentagon, it's like he's a different person. And so my question is, do you have any guesses as to why? Why this different behavior from the same person?
Well, you're asking for an opinion. I mean,
or any. I'm puzzled by it. I can't figure it out.
Allow me to tell you what I think may be behind all of this. And it's a theory, but it rings true to me. And that is, all of this really started, it increased exponentially when the 28 pages were released. And as you know, myself and Nick Harrison and Mike Gravel were absolutely centrally instrumental in getting them released. So when the 28 pages were released, then in short order, JASTA passed almost unanimously, amazingly, in this polarized, divided Congress. The first vote was effectively unanimous in both the House and the Senate, and then after Obama's veto, it was effectively unanimous in the Senate and almost in the House. Close. Once JASTA passed and the sovereign immunity was stripped, was pierced, as they say, legally, to Saudi Arabia, and not only Saudi Arabia, but every other country except for the United States, unfortunately, but every foreign country. So once Saudi Arabia's sovereign immunity was stripped and Judge Daniels finally allowed the 9/11 victim family members' case to move forward against the Saudis, and we're talking about 6,000 or so 9/11 victims' family members and survivors. It's a huge case, the Motley Rice lawsuit. And it also involves the insurance company, who were taken to the cleaners by Larry Silverstein and are trying to get some money back from the Saudis. Now, for myself, there's no question in my mind, but the Saudi involvement was simply they were working with the CIA, they were working with the insiders of the U.S. government and the neocons, and they were setting up the factory. That's clear. So, yes, they're part of the conspiracy, but did the hijackers do it? No. And, you know, there's extremely little evidence, if any evidence, that any of the hijackers got on affirmative evidence in the public domain that any of these alleged hijackers got any of the four planes to begin with. So putting aside the truth or falsity of the official story that there were 15 Saudi hijackers that had any real operational involvement in the attacks, let's assume that that's true for purposes of argument, that they weren't just patsies to be set up to take the blame for the Muslims, then the 9/11 victims' family members' lawsuit that was finally allowed to go forward after the 28 pages were released and then JASTA passed, that lawsuit goes to the deep pockets of the Saudi royal family government. We're talking multiple billions of dollars. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but if you actually read their lawsuit, its foundation is the information in the 28 pages. And the 28 pages is about only two of the alleged 19 hijackers, both Saudis and both on the alleged Flight 77. So if you can't have a serious doubt about Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon or the 9/11 victims' family members' lawsuit fail. And you can't reach the billions and billions of dollars in the deep pockets of the Saudis. I believe that's what's behind all this. Can I prove it? No. That's what I think is happening.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay. And Sherry Jacobs, you've got the last question for Barbara. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Sherry. I wanted to first thank you so much for...
Sherry, I can't hear you.
I think
Hello?
Sherry maybe just got somehow
knocked
off the call.
You.
I think she disappeared. She was in the queue, and then she disappeared. I wonder if she got cut off.
She'll probably call back on.
Yeah.
Okay. So when she does, we'll let her ask her question. I know it's getting... Okay, so if you all want to unmute yourself, and that's star 6, right? That's star 6. And then we can go into the announcement phase, and then when Barbara, when Sherry comes back on, we'll have her ask a question.
Well, I'd like to just make one last comment if I could. Can you hear me?
Yes, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd just like to encourage people, as Marty said, to look at the evidence. Do watch the videos of the conference. And please do watch my rebuttal video, which I will be sending the YouTube link again to Cheryl and Craig to post with this section of our call. So that's it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Barbara. I really appreciate all the information you shared with us tonight. We're not going to hear that anywhere else, so thank you. And we're going to start with the announcements, and I want to ask Carl Gullivan to go first with those because he had something he wanted to share with us. So, Carl, are you still with us and ready to go?
I am. Thank you. I'll be brief.
Okay.
If everyone refers to the announcement for this call, you'll see a link to an article by Kevin Barrett at Veterans Today. And he was wonderful to put together a brief article outlining a question I was able to ask on May 29th at the Brookings Institution of General Joseph Dunford, who is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it was just sort of such a remarkable moment. I wanted to share it with those on the call tonight. Many are probably familiar with Operation Northwoods from the Kennedy administration. Actually, just to back up, my question overall for General Dunford was, someone making noise in the background? My question overall was whether a false flag terrorism attack might be used to lead us into war with Iran. And as background, I asked him, I point out that his predecessor as chairman of the JCS in 1962, Lyman Lemnitzer, had drafted Operation Northwoods, proposing a series of false flag attacks to Kennedy to be used and blamed on Cuba as a pretext to war for Cuba. So it's just sort of amazing to get that out in the public domain, and also referencing Dr. Alan Sabrowski, formerly of the U.S. Army War College, and the writings of the former defense minister of Germany, Andreas von Bülow, on, quote, the false flag aspects of the events on 9/11. So to actually reference false flags on 9/11 to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and see his reaction, which, he's, I guess, used to being placed in awkward situations. His reply was that he wasn't going to respond directly. And then in his answer, I think his answer really allowed for every eventuality, even, I suppose, potentially, that if he were ordered to engage in accepting a false flag as a pretext for war, if he's ordered, he probably would have to do it. But I think Kevin Barrett's interpretation is the best, which is that he's, of course, aware of all these issues. They're even discussed now widely in open source materials, and that he's aware of the potential and will not be misled into making any recommendation based on something that he does not fully understand and has vetted the related intelligence. So that was it. Just love to share that with you. There's a link to the video in Kevin Barrett's article.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. I watched the video, and that was great to hear you ask those and get that out there. And he didn't look too surprised by your comments, I didn't think.
I think we have to, I mean, it's a record there that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has heard the concept that 9/11 was false flag terrorism. And actually, Dr. Alan Sabrowski was a Marine, and surely if any of this was a surprise to the general, he would have his staff look up what Dr. Sabrowski has written about 9/11 and Israeli involvement in it. So I think he knows what's going on, which is encouraging.
Right. Okay, well, thanks, Carl, for that. And any other announcements or anything?
Yes.
No, not at the moment.
Someone else had something?
Can you hear me? It's Barb.
Yes, Barbara.
I don't know if I've sent it already, but if not, I will send it to attach to the announcement section of the minutes. I think I mentioned April's call. I mentioned, I believe, that what was being planned for the upcoming anniversary, and the plans are solidifying. People should know that I will send the flyer for the conference in Zurich, Switzerland, at the Volkshaus, which is the largest public concert hall. It seats almost 1,000 people. and we have rented the hall, and it's going to be an amazing array of speakers on 9/11 Truth, including the flagship keynote address by Professor Daniel Ganser, who is the world's expert on Operation Gladio, false flag attacks during the Cold War by the Pentagon and NATO to blame on the left wing in Europe, especially Italy, but other countries as well. And I will send the flyer. And that's happening. We are hoping to live stream. It's very expensive in Switzerland to do any of this, so we might not be able to live stream, but we will definitely have a professional videographer, and it won't be long before it's on YouTube, good professional quality video of it. It's for 8 hours, goes from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. Zurich time, which is a horrible time in the United States for many others. So you probably wouldn't want to watch the live stream anyway. So, but that is happening, and the Lawyers Committee will have two or three of us participating, and Neil Harris will be speaking. So it's going to be a really exciting event. Also, Nick Harrison, our litigation director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, has decided that he will accept the invitation to speak at the 9/11 Film Festival in California at the Oakland Grand Lake Theater, which is on September 11th itself. The Lawyers Committee will be holding an event in either New York City or Washington, D.C. on the 10th and or the 11th. We may have two events. It's not clear yet. And the lead on that is our president and executive director, David Meiswinkle, with the assistance of Andrew Krieg, who's a 9/11 activist, longtime activist in the D.C. area. So that's happening, and I know that TAP, the Nationwide and Europe TAP people, are putting on events. I know that there will be a big event in The Hague. There will be an event in either Brussels or Amsterdam, I'm not sure which. The Amsterdam 9/11 group, which is headed by Jan van Aken, they have produced a 9/11 newspaper. The current edition is only in Dutch, but they are translating it into English, and it will be made available in time for our event worldwide on the anniversary. It will be at the Zurich event and hopefully also at events here in the United States. And the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers are sending in articles for the English language edition. They have published 150,000 copies and already given out 50,000. They go to a different city in Europe every weekend. So this is a major, major push. And I guess those are the main announcements that I have. I'll send you the flyer for the Zurich event.
Okay, great. Thank you, Barbara. Yeah. Anybody else? I have not an announcement, but just a little feedback. The Red Pill Expo was here in Hartford on June 7th through the 9th, and Richard Gage had a table there. And I worked at his table all day on Friday, and he got a tremendous, tremendous response from these people, and he took in tons of donations. And then when he spoke, I wasn't there to hear him speak, but I was told that he got a standing ovation when he just stepped up on the stage, and then he got another one at the end of his presentation. And we passed out like lots of hundreds of flyers because we were having him speak on Sunday evening at the University of Hartford, you know, our own private event. And tons of people from the left, from the Red Pill Expo, came to it. And it was really very exciting. They were so into it. And they were like, it was like in maybe 2006, all of our excitement or interest or enthusiasm. That's how these people were. So it was very uplifting. And they all got it. And it was just an amazing experience. So, and the lawyers, Mick Harrison and Dave Meiswinkle, came and spoke with Richard Gage at our event in the evening, and I think that was a powerful combination. It was just, I told them they need to take it on the road, the three of them, because it was really great, and the people, I couldn't get them to leave. We were there till like 2011, starting at 7, and they just wouldn't leave. So anyway, it was great, and so if they do go on the road, I would encourage people to have them speak in your area. So,
Cheryl, was there a video of your program?
No, it wasn't videotaped, unfortunately. So, I do have something on my phone that I'm trying to get off, but it wasn't a full one. It was just some of Dave Meisland. If I can get it off, I'll send it around.
Was Richard's presentation at the Red Pill Expo itself videotaped that we could watch?
Yeah, all of that was videotaped, yeah.
Could you send the link in a minute?
I'll have to look it up, but yes. I think if you just go to redpillexpo.com or .org, I can't remember, they'll be there.
Okay.
Red Pill Expo, but I'll look for it and send it also.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other announcements? All right. Well, it's been a really long evening, really interesting one. Thank you for everyone for joining us and for all the speakers. And next month we are pretty filled already. We have Christopher Bolin, Adam Ruff, and Carl Golovin again will be presenting. So we have those three speakers. So if anyone is interested or knows anyone you want to recommend for August, that's what we're looking at. So thanks for everyone's participation and enthusiasm. And we'll see you next month.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. Bye.